Welcome to the latest edition of the IDEA podcast from the Irish Development Education Association. I'm your host, Eimear Green, and today's episode features the first panel session from our virtual conference, Global Citizenship and Inequality in 2021, Forging a New Path. We have four wonderful speakers exploring the questions, after a year of constant change, where are we now? What lessons, if any, have we learned about inequality? With the systems underlying our societies under massive strain, can that ambition to build back fairer survive the pressure? The panel is moderated by Dr. Maria Barry, who is Assistant Professor in the School of STEM Education, Innovation and Global Studies in DCU's Institute of Education. I hope you enjoy.
So this afternoon, we're here to consider what is the main theme of the conference this year, which is inequality, and particularly within the context of COVID and all that that means. And oftentimes for me, having been a long-time advocate of development education and global citizenship education, I think oftentimes we feel like we're dealing in very contemporary, current issues. And indeed, sometimes I worry that we risk being sidetracked by agendas and by issues that seem very, very topical. So I'm really delighted that this afternoon we're going to focus in on the theme of the conference, which is, I suppose, one of the enduring issues that each of us recognise underpins so many of those issues that Richard Wilkinson identified this morning for us. So to help us think about inequality within the context of COVID and where to next, we're going to be supported in that endeavour and provoked in that endeavour from four different perspectives this afternoon. And we're going to hear from four panellists who are joining us. So they are Kathleen Lynch, an Irish sociologist, activist, and Professor Emeritus of Equality Studies at University College Dublin. Martin Collins, co-director of Pave Point, Traveller and Roma Community, and Traveller Rights Activist. Lillian Otiso, Executive Director of LVCT Health Kenya, and Mary Kyo, Advocacy Director of CBM Global and Senior Advisor on Disability and Gender Equality. So we're going to be led in this consideration by these panelists, and we're going to, I suppose, we're asking you to consider a number of key questions. So after a year of constant change, where are we now? What lessons, if any, have we learned about inequality through the lens of COVID? And with our systems underlying our societies under massive strain, can we achieve the ambition to build back fairer? Can we do that? Can we survive the pressure? And we're going to hear from each of those four panelists. And then afterwards, you're going to have an opportunity to unpack and explore some of the key areas that they've raised in small breakout rooms. And we'd also encourage you to add any comments, any ideas to the Slack Tuesday panel session as well. Okay, so I think if that's all the kind of housekeeping, so now is the time to listen to these perspectives. And to begin, I'd like to introduce Professor Kathleen Lynch. So Professor Lynch has worked for many years to promote equality and social justice through research, education, and activism. In 2020, she was appointed as a commissioner of the Irish Equality and Human Rights Commission by President Higgins. So many thanks, Professor Lynch, for joining us here.
Thank you very much, Maria. Thanks very much for inviting me to speak. So I suppose I'm going to talk about, maybe make about three or four points about creating more just worlds. I suppose what I would argue is coming especially from the lessons of COVID that we have to look at the structural foundations of where we're living in the world. I should say, I suppose, not to sell something or anything, but I've just finished a book and it's been published the end of the year on care and capitalism with Polity and Press. So I've been looking at injustice in the world in considerable depth, I suppose, for the last 2 years. And I suppose some of the points that I make here, not all of them by any means, come from that reflection. And the argument I'm making is that capitalism has ethics. It has ethics of competition, acquisition, domination, aggrandizement. It is not without ethics. And I think if we don't have an alternative concept of ethic and social justice and care, we are in a very challenging situation. because we need to address that problem. Of course, there are political and economic issues as well, but I'm just going to focus on this now. And I think it's important maybe to begin to say what neoliberalism, because often people don't say what it is. And I think it's very important that we do, because it is the dominant ideology of our time. There's no question about it. And it is linked to liberalism, which I can't go into here. And it's profoundly anti-egalitarian. It is not to say that war or injustice or sexism or racism are the preserve of capitalism. They're not. The point I'd make is that it builds on pre-existing hierarchies, exacerbates them, and increases the inequality, as we'll see even from a few statistics I'll give about COVID. But it's not just an analytical framework, it is a moral framework. And I think that's rarely said about capitalism, that it is a moral framework as well. For example, it prescribes a very diminutive role for the state, except in insofar as it protects profit-led businesses. State intervention, especially under neoliberalism, new liberalism, is discouraged. The focus on having a small, cheap state and the privatization of public services and goods. And that isn't just true in Western world, it's true throughout the world. Take Pakistan, for example, which is an interesting country which had a national education system in 1974, it introduced it. Now there has been a massive privatization of even primary and second level education, with the resulting consequence that the middle classes and people who are well off can afford better education, and you don't have the same universal system that we have become accustomed to, especially for primary education. And finally, by this idea that you can, the human being can be liberated by through their entrepreneurial skills, creating political and psychological conditions for profit making. Strong private property, free markets, and so-called free trade, which is really trade between the rich, which dominate the terms of trade. And I think what's significant about it, and this had huge impact in terms of COVID and how it worked out, moving public services into the private for-profit sector is an agenda of neoliberalism, including healthcare, childcare, elder care, and of course, health is already a globalized market. There's a huge market in globalized healthcare, as there is, we know from the care chain, as there is in childcare. And what's happening is things are being corporatized. What were human goods and what are human services are being turned into for-profit businesses. Because the whole history around that, I don't have time to explain it here, but it arrived. The fact there is no money to be made often as much now in the Western world, for want of a better word, is not a manufacturing world, with the exception of Germany and Europe. And it has turned to privatizing what are essentially human-based services in order to make profit. The point is, of course, that most nation states are not in control of global capital at all. And they are under pressure, as Ireland and many Western countries is to Britain particularly has done this, to privatize their public services, like the privatization of prisons running from commercial base on a commercial basis in the United States and increasingly in Britain, for example. Higher education is on, as anybody's following CETA or particularly was following TTIP, knows that one of the goals of TTIP was, in fact, to globalize and commercialize higher education. So what I'm saying is there is an ideological struggle that we have to engage in if we want to challenge the ethics that underpin injustice under capitalism. Because ideals such as commoning, degrowth, are presented as if as naive and simplistic. And that is an ideological struggle. If you are to present an alternative, you have to fight for it. And as Gramsci said, there is an ideological war of position. I don't like the metaphor of war, but it's a reality. In ideological terms, there is a war of position. And I think the people who are idealists and progressive thinkers, however you care to look at yourself, they're very naive sometimes, thinking that power will be handed. Power will never be given. Power will be taken. That's how it works. And the feminist movement will give long lessons in that to people who think it's otherwise. So there is this ideological work of making any idealism appear naive, the development of the Tina mentality, and of course, the downgrading of public services through funding, and then the denigrating of them, saying they're inefficient when they are underfunded. So what I'm saying here, if you look at the COVID pandemic, just take during the pandemic, the 18th of March, the 31st of December, worldwide billionaires' wealth increased by 3.9 trillion. That is 3.9 billion, billion US dollars. During the 2020 part, the richest billionaires have massively increased their fund income. 10 richest people have an income which is far in excess of the global, of the GNP of the Irish economy. Who suffered? Well, the people who suffered most were poorest in Ireland, among them travellers, which are very high. I'm sure that Martin would speak about that. And of course, old people, because there is the dispensability of old people, and as particularly old people who live in nursing homes, which in Ireland are completely, almost increasingly commercialised. 80% of them now are run as private for-profit businesses. So I'm saying to you that things matter to people. Oh, I've done a lot of research on care relations, most recently, big study on higher education and people, conflict between their working lives, their personal lives, their care lives, including the care of the environment. And these things matter to people, including the care of non-human animals. But care is silenced as a political issue. There's no nomenclature for it as in ethics. And what happens is, in the pandemic, we saw those who were lack of care ended up in death and illness. And those who were doing hands-on care, mostly women, are, of course, disproportionately affected by COVID, just to show to you. This is a model I'm showing to you, what I published on, how we live not just in economic, political, cultural worlds, but in care worlds. Primary care, secondary care, and the tertiary care sphere of solidarity. And women, of course, are the default carers. Women were adversely affected in Ireland, but in every other country as well. So what I'm saying is capitalism is an ideological system that attracts, and it particularly attracts middle classes. And I think that people forget that. They think it offers excitement, choice, and the myth of merit. And because of that, there is an alignment with its values that has to be contested, and we need to move beyond what I call capital-centred thinking. We need to move beyond the idea that all meaning-making with value is generated in economic relations. Williams, who's Raymond Williams, a famous British social scientist and, I suppose, a social theorist, argued that we have residuals in all culture. Now, we have the residuals of hatred, for example, and nationalism, which are mobilized very much by capitalism, which, of course, benefits hugely from war and from conflict. But we also have an affected domain of life, or people's relationships matter to them. And that became very evident in COVID. People miss touch. They miss feeling and touching each other. They miss their relationships. They miss their friends. So I'm just saying, meaning making occurs in cultural, social, political, and affective fields. People are not simply servants of the market. And to create a new politics of change, we must think of a politics that matters to people. And new mobilizations are required. And not capitalism survives at the moment as it incorporates and reinvents dissent ideologically. It basically reassigns it, you know, starts an LGBT market, starts a market on disability-specific products. It reinvents personal services now. It's become a new product in the market for people with disabilities. And the challenge, I think, is we need new models that aren't capital-centric, but challenges core values. We need to learn, as Peter Valacasa calls about it, we need to learn Haraway to think with care, and as we do, without thinking with competitive advantage. And this, there are numerous examples that I can't go into now of where we have mobilizations, including Italy and in South America. Federici has listed several of them in her book on new thinking and the commons. So I'm just saying there are mobilizations around the world around a new ethics which challenges capitalism. And I'll just give you, just to put it in context, the monetary value of unpaid care work globally for women aged 15 and over is at least $10.8 trillion annually, three times the size of the tech industry. So what I'm saying, these are some readings. If people are interested in this, fantastic book by Joan Tronto on Caring Democracy, Post-Capitalist Politics, the feminist work of Ferici, the New Care Collective publication on the politics of interdependency, Dowling's work on the care crisis, and my own work, which is on effective care and capitalism. So thank you very much. I hope they'll be of help to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathleen, for opening up with such a strong reminder, I suppose, of the dominance of capitalism and of neoliberalism, and this idea of it having this ideology. And I suppose maybe one of the kind of challenges for us then is to think about what are the alternatives, how can we work within that system, and what alternatives can we help to mobilise. And I suppose I was very struck by your idea that power will never be given. And so to kind of think about that as well. And I know we've explored that this morning. So I'm going to move on, if that's OK. So next, we're going to hear from Dr. Mary Kyo. So Mary has a PhD in disability law and public policy, and has experience of working with the UNDP, UN Women, and the EU DevCo. Mary has been providing training in disability inclusion to a vast array of stakeholders, including NGOs, government staff, educators, and academics. So, Mary, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. And again, I'll give you a cue when you have about 2 minutes left. So if you're ready, Mary, I'll hand over to you now.
Great. Thanks a million, Maria. And just reflecting just on your comments there with regard to Professor Lynch's comments around the neoliberalism model and how it leaves behind many people. I'm going to speak a bit to that with regard to persons with disabilities. So just, I guess, to give a quick overview of what I'll just discuss in the next 8 minutes, and I will try and keep within time, is I will respond with just some reflections to the questions that have been posed to this panel. Firstly, looking at the year of constant change, where are we now? And I'm going to speak to the human rights side of that and the development side of it. And then look at what lessons we've learned and reflections around inequality. And then the jargon we have of the moment about build back better. How do we do that? I will address a few points for that. So first of all, just to start off in terms of when we think of where human rights are now currently sitting, with a year to 16 months into the pandemic. In some respects, we're starting further back than before pandemic times. The impact of COVID-19 on persons with disabilities has had some universal truths when it comes to the rights of persons with disabilities. And CBM Global, who I work with, we work internationally, but these, you know, truths are also with respect to the Irish experience as well. So I just wanted to speak a little to some research that was done during the pandemic. This was carried out by the Disability Rights Monitor, and it looked at kind of key areas where disabled people's lives were impacted by the pandemic. And this resulted in disruption of support services, leaving many persons with disabilities locked in their homes. And for those people without a family close by, this meant total isolation and having less support for carrying out daily tasks. It also had a complete failure to protect the lives of persons with disabilities in residential institutions. And I think we saw that also play out in Ireland in terms of access to nursing homes and the closed spaces where people with disabilities live and also other communities live. There was serious and multiple human rights violations against underrepresented populations of persons with disabilities. Women and girls have experienced a major uptick in gender-based violence. Children with disabilities have been denied access to online education due to accessibility. And homeless persons with disabilities have either been rounded up and detained or left completely to fend for themselves. And lastly, and I suppose the most concerning trend we saw in terms of a reversal of human rights was the denying of basic and emergency healthcare to persons with disabilities. And across the globe last year, there was a number of, you know, worrying reports about the adoption of discriminatory triage procedures. In some cases, persons with disabilities were denied access to treatment for COVID-19 because of their disability. So I think when we think about the year of constant change, this is, you know, I suppose, stark reminders that the platitudes that we give to ourselves around progress, and, you know, sometimes progress has been made, when it comes down to the really fundamentals in terms of how we are structured as a society, and particularly with regard to persons with disabilities were left behind in all responses, and even in terms of building back better, as I'll speak to a bit later also on. So just in terms of reflecting from the development perspective, and, you know, last year we had the high level political forum on the SDGs. And if we were to look back at the last 18 months, I suppose maybe some reflections about where we can say we are now as we come around to another UN meeting reflecting on SDG implementation, which will take place next month. We can say that while the goals are universal, and they were very universal in terms of their development, their implementation at country level has been severely impacted by the pandemic. The high-level political forum, which opened in 2020, had the sobering realization that the pandemic had risked reversing decades of progress in poverty and hunger, and places even greater obstacles on the way to many for the implementation of the SDGs in many countries. Implementation of goals such as Goal 1, poverty reduction, Goal 3, health, Goal 5, gender equality, and Goal 8, inclusive, sustainable growth and decent work for all, and Goal 10 on inequalities between countries will require an extra emphasis to try and claim back some of the ground that has been achieved over the earlier years of the SDGs. And then from a disability inclusive perspective, each of these goals also remains critical for making gains in development. For example, country level research that we are launching today, which we've done in partnership with researchers with disabilities across three countries, highlight that health, livelihood and gender equality remain critical areas to underpin disability rights within a development context. I suppose lastly, on the point of where we are now in terms of the year of change, in June 2020, I remember speaking with my team, kind of talking about the analogy of a boat. We're very far from land and without directions for safe passage on how to get back. And a year later, some of us are nearer to a sense of security, closer to shelter, closer to vaccine rollouts. And we're waiting to see if any of the positive changes that came through the pandemic, because there were some, and I'll speak to them in the Build Back Better piece. But overall, we're feeling safer from the immediate threats of COVID-19. But for the hundreds of millions of people living in the countries that we all work in, they are not as near to that safety and shelter that we feel. And the solidarity and collective approach that has underpinned international cooperation for the past 50 years is needed now more than ever. We morally and ethically cannot leave behind countries who are calling out for support with vaccines and other life-saving and economic socio supports. So in terms of what lessons that we've learned, I think the crisis has, you know, shone a light on the lack of policy coherence in many aspects. And this is a critical area for us to think about. In terms of governments responding during the pandemic, looking at how to make sure that those who are most marginalized are part of the response and are included in the response and co-developing it is extremely critical. And from a disability perspective, you know, the impact of discriminatory laws and policies have always been there. Ireland has ratified the CRPD, and many of the countries that we've ratified the CRPD, many of the countries we work in have ratified the CRPD. So therefore, the policy reform and the budget allocation that needs to come for inclusion needs to be part of Build Back Better. And just, I suppose, lastly, just to the third kind of the broader reflection around Build Back Better is we need to be more representative. And how do we make our systems more representative? Politics is failing to represent people who are most impacted by inequality. And as a result, people are disengaging. Persons with disabilities the world over remain outside the rooms of where decisions are made. And until this change happens for persons with disabilities and other groups, the systems that we work within will always be under pressure. Thank you.
Mary, thank you so much for that. I mean, I think you drew on research and you drew on the metaphor of the boat to really kind of powerfully exemplify and illustrate how COVID has really amplified a lot of you know, enduring issues and challenges in relation to accessibility, in relation to human rights. And even fundamentally in highlighting how our society is structured. And then you gave those really clear examples of the kind of disruption to support services, the isolation, the failure to protect and preserve the human rights of peoples with disabilities. And I suppose, finally, when you were thinking about this notion, you know, the risk of going beyond jargon of building back better and thinking about how even you're at a stage where progress has been reversed as a result of this crisis. And I suppose of the need to ensure that as we emerge from the emergency of COVID, that we work on issues like representation and a more equal, let's say, recovery, for want of a better word, for all. So thank you very much, Mary, for that powerful contribution. Okay, so if we're still okay, I'm going to move on now to our next contribution and our next panelist. So now I'm pleased to welcome Martin Collins. So Martin has been a traveller rights activist for over 30 years. He represented Pavé Point on the Government Task Force on Travellers in the early 90s and was also a Human Rights Commissioner between 2002 and 2007. So at the moment, he's a member of the Advisory Committee for the Council of Europe Framework Convention for the Protection of National Minorities. So Martin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation to present here today. Well, yeah, I work with Pavé Point Travel and Roma Centre, and we're a national travel and Roma rights organisation. We were established in 1985, and essentially it's about promoting the attainment of human rights for travellers in Roma in a number of different spheres: education, health, accommodation, employment, and so on. One of the big battles we had in Pavé Point was challenging the racist ideology that we travellers were in some way a broken people who needed to be fixed by the majority population. So in other words, we didn't have a culture, we didn't have an identity, we didn't have a language, we didn't have a history. But of course, we have all of that. But the prevailing analysis for centuries on the island was that we were a failed, settled people who just need to be civilised and normalised by the state. That racist ideology prevailed for many centuries. And it wasn't really until the 1st of March 2017, our Taoiseach, Enda Kenny, in the Oireachtas, made a very profound statement recognising the distinct ethnic identity of travellers. So that was a really historic moment in our struggle. But of course, the recognition of ethnicity is not a panacea. It's not going to resolve the individual and the institutionalised racism that travellers continue to experience. And that will need a different a policy response to address those issues. Now, of course, that individual and institutional racism, we can see the manifestations of that on a whole number of fronts. For example, we can see it in the health inequalities, that I, as a travel man, live 15 years less than a settled man. A travel woman lives on average 12 years less. Our infant mortality rate is four times higher than the national average. You know, only 3% of travellers live to be 65 years of age. We can see in the education that only 13% of travellers complete secondary education compared to 97% in the majority population. We can see it in the disproportionate representation of travellers in prisons. In fact, we have more travellers in prison than we do in universities. You know, we can see it in the 85% unemployment rate. These are all examples of the ongoing institutionalised racism that travellers experience. Now, of course, this inequality and racism as experienced by travellers, you know, it didn't come about as a result of COVID. You know, it existed, as we all know, well before COVID. And this has been well documented by our Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, the ESRI Economic and Social Research Institute, and indeed various international human rights bodies. So in other words, it's not just Pavé Point is saying it. But what COVID did do, COVID did amplify and reinforce these inequalities. For example, we have, you know, travellers are disproportionately represented in the homeless population. Even though we only make up, you know, less than 1% of the total population, we actually constitute 15% of the homeless population. So as you can see, we are disproportionately represented. We have thousands of traveller families, men, women and children living on unofficial sites or living on official sites that lack the basic essentials. So even during COVID, you know, many, many travel families couldn't meet the basic public health requirements in terms of social distancing, in terms of washing hands, because they were living in overcrowded conditions, didn't have access to sanitation and water supply in the middle of a public health emergency. So that's what I mean about amplifying and reinforcing the inequality as experienced by travellers. You know, how am I optimistic? I don't know, to be quite frank with you, if this will be a new beginning, if lessons will be learned in terms of how we go about, you know, coming out of the pandemic and constructing a more fair, more pluralist and a more inclusive society. I'm, you know, I don't mean to be too negative, but I'm, I I'm afraid I don't see any evidence of that, and I'm not very optimistic. And I'll give you an example of that. The Irish state, I mean, people will know that the European Commission have put in place a 750 billion recovery package for the European Union. And that would be distributed among the 27 member states. Ireland had to submit its National Resilience and Recovery Plan to the European Commission to draw down its part of the funding. And we made a submission to the state's National Recovery and Resilience Plan. Nowhere in that plan does it make any reference to racism, to ethnic minorities, or to poverty reduction. Now, maybe I'm being very simplistic, but if you use that as an example, it doesn't really give you much optimism. And I would agree with a lot of what Kathleen has said there about, I think, essential public services have become privatised, have become commodified, motivated by profit. And another example of that would be in 2020, 503 million was spent by the Irish state on the HAP programme alone, going to private landlords. It's an incredible amount of money, 503 million to private landlords through HAP and RAS. Money that could have been and should have been used for public house building, social and affordable housing. Our strategy, again, that's just another example of the neoliberalism model, where we are looking to and dependent on the private sector to address the problems. And of course, we know that hasn't worked. If anything, the housing situation has grown from crisis to crisis. But that's just an example. In 2015, of the 31 local authorities in the state, between them, they only constructed 75 houses. That's an absolutely, I don't know, it's incredible. So again, that's just to reinforce the point about this neoliberal model and privatising and commodifying essential services such as education, health, you know, how deep is your pocket sort of thing. The last point I would make in racism, for me is inherent in capitalism, it's inherent in colonialism, and it's inherent in imperialism. And I don't think we can address racism adequately or effectively without addressing all of the other issues. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Martin, thank you so much for that. And I suppose important to acknowledge your caution around this idea of building back better and, you know, pointing to very practical examples like, you know, where is the evidence of this? So looking at even the government response in terms of its recovery and resilience plan and the lack of acknowledgement of ethnic minorities, lack of evidence or lack of kind of acknowledge around kind of, I suppose, how racist ideologies can underpin and be amplified by current crisis that we have. And I suppose kind of, you know, similar themes. So I think it's important that we're not naive enough to think about this idea of building back better when perhaps some of the evidence in terms of policy responses or indeed current government expenditure points in another direction. So maybe some really practical examples there as well. And of course, again, thinking about how those threads between the panelists in relation to human rights, government accountability, and also, I suppose, thinking about both ideologies that pervade in addition to policy development as well. So thank you very much for that contribution, Martin. Okay, so we're going to move on now to our final panellist and our final contribution. I'm delighted to introduce now Dr. Lillian Otiso. So Lillian is the Executive Director of one of the largest Indigenous NGOs in Kenya. And this NGO carries out research and implements HIV, gender-based violence and community health programs reaching over 1 million individuals across Kenya annually. No mean feat. She's a medical doctor with an MBA in healthcare management, a fellow in the inaugural Obama Foundation Leaders Africa 2018 program, and a winner of the Trokara Oscar Romero Award in 2021. So Lillian, you're very welcome.
Great. I'll be talking about COVID-19, looking at the health and gender lens. And my talk is based on our work from LVCT Health and just experiences we've had in Kenya. And as you've heard, LVCT is a large NGO and we focus on the needs of the vulnerable and marginalized. And we have been involved in HIV, sexual reproductive health, gender-based violence programming. And so we fit right into COVID when it came. And so I'll be sharing some of the things that what we have learned or what we've seen as we have been programming and since COVID started in Kenya. And so that slide talks about the basically COVID in Kenya, where the first case was diagnosed in March last year. So we've been, and from that point, we had a lot of measures put in place to really minimize the risk of spreading the infection to others. And this was set up by government, and the response has been led by government across the country. We are currently experiencing our third wave, as you can see there, so it keeps getting progressively worse. The numbers came down. That's just the... And something to talk about, just testing. So in Nairobi, we had our third wave, which has reduced, but now we have a high number of infections in the western part of the country. So we keep having it that way. It moves from Nairobi to the other sections. And so far, we have 179,000 confirmed cases with 3,500 deaths. But the caveat here is these are only those that are confirmed by testing. So we expect that the actual numbers could be five times more than this or way more. So some of the measures that were put in place were like a national curfew, which we have had for the last 1 year. So we have a nationwide curfew of 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. And depending on at the peak of the wave, it comes down to, say, 8 p.m. or 7 p.m. And we also have restriction of movement in and out of different counties or districts. So like now we have the western part of Kenya, movement is restricted in and out of there. Schools were closed for 9 months, which had a lot of bearing on some of the effects that we saw. Bars and restaurants were closed, but these, every time we have a peak, they close, then they reopen. So they are open now, at least in Nairobi. Public transport was expected to transport half the passengers to minimize the risk. And this increased the costs, so just double the cost of transport, because the public transportation is private, so people have to pay for those services. We have a compulsory mask mandate in the country, and sometimes enforcement has been part of the challenge, depending on how the police will come and bear down on people if they're not wearing masks or arrest them. So my talk is really focused on the effect of this on the vulnerable and marginalized populations that LBCT works with and what we've seen across. So the businesses were severely affected. Hospitality industry, just like the rest of the world, school and school business and those who support that, and small businesses. But also we know large businesses were affected, and this resulted in severe loss of income, and loss of food and shelter was very serious. And we don't have social support structures that can be able to sustain people. So there were a few measures by government to provide stipends, but those were for a limited number of people, and we don't have a registry to know who's vulnerable. Health services were quite affected. We had, initially, there was a lot of panic, even by health workers and health facilities. So when they would, a health worker would test positive, the whole facility would be closed, limiting access to for other people. And this was particularly bad for women and children, who are the ones who frequent facilities the most. So like the what were considered not essential, like the sexual reproductive health clinics would be closed, the family planning clinics or antenatal care sometimes would be closed. Some maternity wards were turned into isolation wards, and so women had to go much further to find places to deliver. Patients were limited in accessing facilities to avoid crowding, and there was just general lack of the personal protective equipment. So the other things were stigma and discrimination. That photo you can see at the top there is how when the epidemic began, and anybody was tested positive, the people dressed in white would go fetch them from the house. It was very dramatic, and take them to the hospital. So this created a lot of fear and stigma. The myths and misconceptions that persist up to now, and people are in denial. They don't want to be branded as having COVID. Gender-based violence has been talked about in so many places, and this was really increased. We had sexual violence. People were locked in. A girl trying to go to the toilet outside in a slum at night were raped, and we know of intimate partner violence and violence against children. We've also seen an increase in pregnancies and HIV and STIs, not to mention the mental health effects that we're still monitoring up to now. At the health system level, we've managed to do almost 2 million tests, but this is a drop in the ocean. Testing is very expensive, so you have to pay for it, meaning a lot of people were denied access to these services. And some services stopped, like testing for HIV, that lack of oxygen and drugs. So from that perspective, what we have learned and the lessons that I'm sharing here is that we have to have what I would take and share back to policymakers if we had to do this again is use localized responses that involve communities. If you're saying that people have to wear masks or must wash their hands or socially distance, what should you do in a slum setting? So the communities there can give a lot of input. And we have to consider the needs of the vulnerable when making decisions like lockdowns, like transport being limited, people being unable to move around. We have to look at what that means and tackle stigma and myths and misconceptions right from the beginning to avoid what we've seen where up to now there's heavy, heavy stigma around COVID. We need data continuously on who's vulnerable and who's marginalized so that when we're making interventions, we address those. So like there's a study we're doing right now to see who is disabled, the elderly, or the child-headed homes, the orphans, that can help government to then be able to inform future interventions. And we have to invest in strengthening their health system so that they can deal with this epidemic and future epidemics, remembering that health is for all and not just for some. So I can't finish without talking about COVID vaccine, and this is really what is for us troubling. We are basically running out of COVID vaccines. And as you can see from the graph on the right and what I've shaded in red, only less than 1% of Kenyans are vaccinated. And Kenya as a country has the capacity to scale up its vaccine coverage. We have systems across the country that we usually use and have been shown to work even now. So about 1 million people have got the first dose, and now we're struggling and running out of doses for the second dose. And as you can see on the left from today's headline, poor countries have run out of vaccines and we're not able to access any more. So with few coming in, like today, we're able to get some from Denmark because they were not using AstraZeneca. So we've seen that these are huge gaps that have come through, and the inequality is really felt when we're seeing that countries like the US, for example, are almost vaccinating everyone, yet we've been unable to reach our health workers or the vulnerable, who in total would make less than 3 million or 4 million individuals. So just to add some quotes from a high level people who are talking about this, we need to remember that the pandemic will not end until everybody is really reached and protected. Otherwise, we'll keep getting these waves that are coming through. So we have to have global accountability for COVID vaccine to ensure that all health workers and the marginalized and elderly are reached, and as we continue with the other measures, we have to avoid hoarding of vaccines or delaying up to the point when they expire, which is what we're seeing. And that aspect of allowing vaccine manufacturing in low and middle income countries. So we're happy today to see that there's some progress. South Africa is planning to do this manufacturing, but it is disturbing for us to see how much it's a struggle to even get access or the rights to do that. And so we hope that developed countries can see the value in investing in the systems in low and middle income countries, as opposed to treating this like charity. Thank you.
Lillian, thank you so much for such a comprehensive overview of COVID from the perspective of Kenya, and I suppose in particular vulnerable and marginalised communities that you were working with. And I suppose your presentation kind of exemplified the domino effect, you know, so amplifying or showing how, again, COVID impacts on people's livelihoods, on their work, and then how that then impacts on their household income, on their food security, and looking even at issues of gender-based violence and women and girls at risk. And I suppose, you know, that kind of heightened sense of a lack of social supports that are available to vulnerable communities and to Kenyan citizens. And indeed, finishing with this message around vaccine equality and the need for accountability and responsibility in relation to that, and the need for the international community to respond. So, folks, that's the end of the contributions. Many thanks to Kathleen, to Mary, to Martin, and to Lillian for those thought-provoking presentations.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to check out our website for more. Until the next time.